All right, guys, thanks a lot for being patient. How's everybody doing? Ladies and gentlemen, we've had her on the show. I think a lot of you have checked out her show, but Smart Mouth is one of the best food podcasts out there. We're so psyched to have him here at Scoop Fest. So please give it up for Catherine Spires. Smart Mouth.
Hi, everybody. Oh, where am I? Thank you so much for waiting. I think it's worth it because of the Mai Tais. Can you hear me? Okay, we're going to sit down. This is my guest this week, Alan Katz. He's the one who actually made the Mai Tais, so let's give it up to him. Really? He is a bar... Do you guys still call yourself mixologists, or what happened with that?
Yeah, okay, so... Can y'all hear me? Awesome. So when the term mixologist came around, that was when, like... taking bartending as a craft was really weird. So they did need a term to like cordon it off and say, hey guys, we're doing something different. So Dale DeGroff unearthed that term. But now we don't really need it. We're bartenders.
We're allowed to call you bartenders?
It's my place. Okay. So technically I'm the executive busboy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. The fanciest busboy. So yes, he works at an executive busboys at Jamieland, which is in downtown Las Vegas. Is that what we call it?
Yeah. Heart of the Arts District, right across from Makers and Finders and Hop Nuts.
Yes.
Main and Charleston.
I went there last night and the food was actually good. Not just saying that. So if you have time for
dinner. Oh my God, actually good? Come now.
Shockingly edible, says Gourmet Magazine. So I actually met Alan a couple years ago in LA, which is where I live, where he was developing this bar program for a restaurant owned by a friend of mine, and he made such a splash because he created, you guys, a Mai Tai that cost $26. Right? How many would pay $26 for a Mai Tai? Not a lot of hands, but what if it was like made with a rum that... what was it? No one else could get or something?
Okay, so that was actually the cheapest fancy Mai Tai in recent history. The guys that own the Dead Rabbit and Blacktail in New York City, when they managed the Merchants Hotel in Belfast, charged $1,230 for a Mai Tai containing original J. Ray and Nephew 17-year-old rum, the rum that inspired the cocktail, which is extinct. That bottle auctioned for $55,000.
Everyone's got a hobby, right?
So while the rest of us rum geeks were about ready to throw in the towel, out of literally nowhere, this little distributor in California starts selling this rum by the guys that make Smooth Ambler bourbon, which is some great stuff. So Smooth Ambler bottled up this rum they called Revelation. They're like, it's Jamaican rum from the 80s. One of our whiskey foragers found it in Canada. It was like an old disused tanker of it. And they're like... you willing to just take this off our hands? We need more space.
Oh my God.
So they bought it for next to nothing. They bottled, and while the rum itself was over 30 years old in the steel tanks, the age is questionable, but we know that it was rum intending to be blended, therefore much older than the 12-year-old blend that is typically available, making
obviously
it the eldest Jamaican rum out there. And I called all my rum nerd friends, like, what do you know about this Revelation rum? And they're like, absolutely nothing. I'm like, where'd you find it? I'm like, I read every line of the catalog. I've been working in Vegas. I needed to like refresh on what's in California. So we just ordered a bottle, and the day it came in, that was like Chef's last day of food testing. And Chef Jonathan Whitener out there at Here's Looking at You and soon to be All Day Baby. He is such a tiki nerd that he is one of like 70 people to have their own mug at the Tiki Tea. And the Tiki Tea has been open for twice as long as he's been alive. People
legendary
that drink there
bar
four times a week, mind you, they're open 5 days.
Oh, I know.
People that drink 4 days a week can't get a mug there.
It's a real scene. And we are going to be talking about Tiki because Alan and I are united in our love of all things Tiki. And we want to explain like really where it came from. The first thing, though, I think that the Mai Tai is the most important Tiki cocktail. Could you give them just the ingredient list of what goes into said drink? Please... everybody who's allergic to almonds, please have already said that to us so we didn't give you a drink.
Yeah. Okay. So Trader Vic Bergeron was inspired by this 17-year-old rum, and he wanted to create something that emphasized all of the notes that he picked out in it. So orgeat, which is a slightly bitter almond syrup. Our recipe is kind of secretive, but there's a ton of great recipes online. So that's the sweet modifier. Orange Curacao to bring it together, lime juice for the acidity, and 2 ounces of rum. So back then it was the 17-year-old Jay Ray and nephew, and it was such a craze that they ran out of all of it.
Yeah.
And then they started making it with 15-year-olds.
They literally ran out of a type of rum in the world. That's how much people liked this drink. And you'll notice, too, that there's lime juice in it, but there's no, like, pineapple juice. There's no orange juice, which I think a lot of people think tiki drinks are, like, just, like, 3/4 of a cup of banana juice. I don't know. And then the rest rum. But it's more artsy than that, I think.
Yeah. I would call tiki the high wire act of mixology, because if you throw these recipes off to the slightest degree, like, the symphony of flavors is gone. And the years of them just being slush buckets.
Slush buckets, yes.
Really kind of destroyed what was like the last big leap in bartending in America. The world, actually.
So you were mentioned craft cocktails earlier, and people talk about that like that's relatively new. But I actually think that craft cocktailing really got its start in the 1930s when tiki was more or less invented.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the label craft is what we had to slap on it now.
Yes.
But yeah, bartending was a craft going back to almost its earliest times. Like, even when they were slinging grog and shrubs, like, there was an art to what they were doing, and they took it seriously.
And what is, there's like an algorithm for making drinks properly. It's the one of sour. What's the rest of it? Do you remember this? One of sour, two of sweet.
Three of strong.
Four of weak. Which is like a nice little thing that comes from the Atlantic side of things. Now, here's the deal with like the Atlantic Ocean being involved in rum and tiki. Rum comes from the Caribbean, and it was part of the awful so-called triangle trade because slaves made the sugar and then they made the rum. And we just took the rum, right? And brought it over here.
Yeah, well, thanks to Prohibition.
Yes.
Rum was so overstocked when the guy that invented it, Don the Beachcomber, when he opened his first place in L.A., he just bought all the rum because it was super cheap. And then he got inspired once he really got to know each bottle.
Yes. So that's the main thing. People get confused and think that tiki is an actual Polynesian thing or an actual part of Hawaiian culture. It sure isn't.
Yeah, Don the Beachcomber brought Polynesia back to Polynesia shortly.
Interesting.
Yeah, so shortly before Hawaii became a state and people were really beginning to recognize it, he went there and he was hoping for paradise. And while everything was full of natural splendor, all of the marks of Polynesia were erased by Victorian missionaries that basically carved a new culture in there and had a very active campaign going for over 100 years to erase all traces of native culture.
Yes.
He brought it back, and that's why so many of the cocktails from that era, Vicious Virgin, Missionary's Downfall, like...
So he had an agenda.
He certainly did.
Beyond just getting drunk, which is a fun part of it. So, but it is important to say that, like, tiki really was invented in Hollywood, because I think a lot of... It's not meant to be real Polynesia. And tikis are the representations of Polynesian gods, so there is... should be respect to them, except for in tiki bars, it's all theater. Don the Beachcomber, who invented tiki bars, he was actually a set designer for movies. And so the types of bars that he was creating were meant to look like movies, not like anything real.
Yeah, it was actually all the stuff that he used in the movies. He started getting hired on movie sets for all of this crazy bric-a-brac that he got on his world travels.
Mm-hmm.
And then he hung it all in the bar.
And his name was Ernest Gant, but he changed his name to Don Beach.
With two N's.
With two N's. Don with two N's. Beach. And then he met a woman who had also changed her name, and her name was Sunny Sund. So we had Don Beach and Sunny Sund. And she was described in the Saturday Evening Post as being a blonde who was long-gammed and deep-bosomed. So you get the idea. Exactly.
Power couple.
Yes, such a power couple. Except for they got divorced and didn't like being married to each other, but they were a really good business team.
Yeah, that's why he went to Hawaii, because she had all the rights in the States, and Hawaii wasn't a state yet.
She was such a smart lady. I liked her. When they split up, Amazing. She's like, I own the rights to this. And he was like, whatever, I don't care. And then he was like, oops, forgot about money.
Hey, she paid him $1 million.
Oh, that's nice of her. But he did go back and just live out his days in Hawaii, right?
Yeah, he died abroad on his tiki houseboat.
He had a tiki houseboat? Like done in tiki style? Wow, what a guy. So they opened the first Don's Beachcomber Cafe in 1933, and then in 1937 they moved across the street and got one with a kitchen. And this became one of Hollywood's main hotspots. We had Marlena Dietrich and Greta Garbo. The Marx Brothers would show up. And as we all know, where the celebrities go, there go the photographers. And Don invented all these drinks for them. The zombie, they always say you can't have more than two.
You can.
But don't you think Don probably said that just so that people would think it was exciting and order two of them?
I've seen a lot of Adweek all-time lists where the zombie is on there as one of the 50 most influential marketing ploys ever.
Oh, yes. That's the thing with Tiki. It's all marketing and magic and...
Theater.
Yes. And I really think, I don't know, you tell me, I feel like before Tiki cocktails, people were expecting less out of cocktails, like maybe two, maybe three ingredients total, and Tiki was the one who, like, let's layer a bunch of ingredients.
Absolutely correct.
Oh, yeah, I love it when I know things. So, Sonny took over the business, even when they were still together, working together. But she let him do the fun stuff. Here's one of my favorite Don stories. Sometimes when it was overcast out at night, it gets overcast a lot in Los Angeles, but it doesn't often rain. But he would climb up onto the roof of the bar with a hose and just start pouring water so that people would hear it and be like, oh, no, it's raining out, and we don't like to drive in the rain, so let's get another drink. Bad idea, but it worked for his purposes of getting people to stick around, which I think is delightful and would probably practically be illegal these days. He also kept a chopstick cabinet. Do you know about this?
Yeah. Yeah. The carved chopsticks in Hollywood and then Palm Springs, they went gold.
Gold chopsticks. So he would have this curio cabinet, and he would have these cups with people's names on them with their chopsticks in it. This is probably another marketing scheme because it was obviously all the celebrities' names. But apparently it's said that Howard Hughes was one who kept chopsticks there. What do we know about Howard Hughes? Germaphobe. He didn't have chopsticks just hanging out at a bar for him to eat with. This is such a lie. But I like the lie.
The lie's awesome.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear the story about Howard Hughes clothing the entire staff?
No.
So Howard would wear a suit once and throw it out, and his limo driver would stuff the trunk with all of the discarded suits, and they were the best-dressed kitchen on earth. He'd hook them up in the alley once Howard went in through his private entrance.
All this stuff sounds pretty kitschy to us these days, but the place was really considered to be really classy back then.
It was fine dining.
Fine dining, because they served Cantonese food. They didn't call it Chinese food. They called it Cantonese, which back then was whoa, from an actual region of China? We know what we're talking about. It seems so normal now, but back then, it was a big deal.
It was novelty.
Yes.
And America's eyes were opening to the world at large.
Yeah, absolutely. To dine at Don the Beachcomber, men had to wear sports coats. And the ladies wore furs in their finest dress. Sunny Sun said, no cigarette girls. Get that out of there. I didn't know about this. I just knew they existed, but apparently it was only tacky places had cigarette girls. So they weren't allowed at the tiki restaurants at first. let's see. So we've been talking about Don Beach mostly, but there were two frenemies who really, between the two of them, I would say, invented tiki.
As we know it, yeah.
Yeah. And as much as I am into Don Beach because he was such a weirdo, I have to say that this other guy was the inventor of the Mai Tai, so we have to give big ups to him. And that was a person who we all know as Trader Vic. What do you know about Trader Vic?
Well, his name actually predated his tiki chain. When Vic opened his first restaurant across the street from his family's grocery store in Oakland, it was called Hinky Dinks. And he was all about that, I guess, what eventually became the template that Fridays use. I can't believe I never even thought of this before. It was just all kinds of hunting, lodgy, weird stuff all over the place. And he constantly, he was a really gregarious guy. And he would always tell his guests, hey, if you have any more stuff like this, bring it in. I'll trade you.
Yep.
So he was already Trader Vic.
Yeah, he just loved to have bric-a-brac everywhere around him.
And the first time he went to Don the Beachcomber, it blew his mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Apparently they couldn't get rid of him.
Yeah. Yeah, they asked him to leave, and he spent the entire night waiting outside trying to get back in. That is dedication.
It's kind of dedication.
He was like an early stan.
Yes, such a stan, a tiki stan. Absolutely. That's good. I never thought about that. He also thought that having just like shit everywhere all over the walls of your restaurant, that your diners would be in there going, oh, hey, what's that? Oh, yeah, I will have another drink. Thanks. Oh, and what's that? It was all about making as much money, selling as many drinks as possible. My God, these people would be arrested for manslaughter now.
Only in states with dram shop laws, not like ours.
I don't know what that means, but I know Vegas, yay.
Yeah, so like New York has dram shop laws where you could be responsible for stuff.
Oh,
Nevada, not so much.
Got it. I see. Well, that makes everything make a lot of sense.
Now you know why there's all the lawyer billboards.
Yes, I had not thought about that. This place is a trip. So Trader Vic was also, I would say, goofier than Don Beach.
Yeah, both men were, if you really had to categorize them, going back to the theatricality of both their enterprises, they were method actors. I mean, Don wore all of his international regalia every day, and Trader Vic had a wooden leg from polio, but as soon as Hinky Dinks became Trader Vic's, he would be showing it off, running a knife into it, making people squeal, and then saying, oh, hey, it's wooden. A shark bit it off.
Yes. He literally took advantage of his prosthetic leg to tell stories. That's the thing, too, about these guys. They both lied and said that they had been to Hawaii before they opened the restaurants. No, sir, they had not. Big liars.
Don Beach did go on a big travel, though. Farther South Seas. Like, that was...
After, though, right? Like, after he'd already started claiming and, like, doing the movie sets and being like, you can trust me, I know what it looks like firsthand.
Legend has it that his grandfather offered him two paths.
Right.
He was like, you could travel the world or you could go to college. I'm going to hook you up with one of those. And being the original beach bum, he was like, yeah, I'm going to travel. The other stuff sounds like work.
Yeah, I guess I just don't know grandfathers who are like, do whatever you want and I'll give you money. Like, it's usually... has a little bit of some rules attached to it, but maybe his grandpa was the original cool grandpa.
Definitely.
Definitely. Yeah, the thing with the wooden leg that Trader Vic had, too, is that he would sometimes hire an actor to come in, running in with a knife, and just stab him and get everyone to scream and cry, and then he'd be like, just kidding! So, I don't think I would like that, but it went over well in the 40s, I guess.
It would be jarring.
Yeah, jarring, indeed. So all these things like stabbing fake legs and all that sort of stuff, standing on roofs, seems like it does sound a little tacky when you say it, right?
Tacky now, because
tacky now,
I think
right?
Our values have shifted.
Right.
But we're making a podcast. I mean, we're inundated with entertainment in every possible form,
yes.
Constantly.
Yes.
And back then, not so much. Radio, you know?
So you're saying that people were so bored. But really, that like it became something that was like interesting to them because it was new?
Yeah, I think, that's where people were also looking for some theater. They wanted to, forget the Depression. They wanted to get over the Great Wars.
Right.
They wanted distraction and, most importantly, to be transported.
Yes. And that's such a huge part of it, too, is that it did come up right after, during the Depression. And one thing you'll notice about old-style tiki bars is they do not have windows. And it really is meant to be a true escape. You're not supposed to see the outside world. Is that correct?
I think I've damaged my eyes leaving Frankie's.
Absolutely.
So many times.
Have any of you been to Frankie's here? Right?
Yeah.
Such a good bar. And yes, truly, you walk into it, even if you walk in at 10 p.m., you walk into Frankie's and your eyes have to adjust. It's so dark. Unbelievable. But everyone should go because it's in the parking lot of a gas station.
And when you leave, like 9 hours later, just like cover your face.
Yeah. It's all part of the experience.
Right.
But it was during the Depression, wanting to escape your woes. It was a lot of GIs who had come back from the Pacific Theater who, I would guess, wanted to pretend that they had had a really lovely time in the war.
Yeah, I think, they did see a lot of stuff that was wondrous because, again, like radio mm-hmm. was the main medium. You had radio and film.
Right.
Really.
Right.
So, like, they wanted to take back the pleasant side of that and, probably indulge in fantasies that they might have had in a foxhole, thinking this might be my last moment.
Right. Right. That makes a lot of sense. And you got to figure, as with all things, young people like something and then they get older and they have kids. And to their kids, that thing is the most humiliating thing that was ever invented. And that's probably why tiki kind of died out, right?
Yeah, but it did survive a full two generations.
Like low-key.
However, it really melded. Like Mick, the guy that did most of the wood carving for for Don, he later became like a modern sculpture artist. And like as his work progressed and he was doing more and more things, moving on from tiki bars to airports and like office parks and apartment buildings, a lot of his stuff took on this like literally alien quality where there's like, it's kind of pagan, but it's also very late mid mod space odyssey oriented.
Okay.
So it really adjusted and changed. I'd say the entertainment explosion in latter years is probably what killed it off, because like the Aku Aku here in Vegas went strong from 1960, but by 1980 it was on its last legs.
Yeah.
When the lease was ending there, but they opened it in 1960 with Don as a consultant, and
okay,
it was like the place for well over a decade.
So I think that Andy Warhol got super into the Trader Vic's in New York City in the early 80s. And in terms of genuine enthusiasm, that had to have really been the death knell, because he was so into irony and kitsch.
Yeah.
And then he publicly talked about how much he likes Trader Vic's. So that's really got to ruin the business, I think.
If anything, it probably was kitsch taking a back seat to, you know, the all new wave, really.
Oh.
You know, we had art rock in the 70s and glam, and things started getting weird. And then punk was just aggressively weird, and then new wave, like, everybody was so focused on the future, they wanted to shed the past, and hard.
Okay, all right. And then we started getting into craft cocktails, when would you say? Was it be late 90s or 2000s, or?
Early 2000s.
Early 2000s.
There was Absinthe in San Francisco.
Sure.
They were on it early. The legendary New York restaurateur, Joe Baum, tapped Dale DeGroff and gave him his collection of antique bar books and said, I want this in all of my places.
Okay.
So that's where that sparked in New York. But people didn't start opening like their own tiny bars until I'd say like 2001. There was, there was Employees Only, Milk and Honey, Pegu Club was... I remember getting indoctrinated into the scene shortly before Pegu Club opened, because I had a regular that was friends with Dale and Audrey Saunders and that crowd. And I'm like just making daiquiris, squeezing limes the way my uncle taught me. You know, just because like this tastes so much better than freaking Rose's lime juice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
fella,
Morton Fink, real name. Handlebar mustache and everything. Completely lecherous old man. He was incredible. He's like, you know what you're doing? That's mixology. I'm like, Morton, I'm sorry, but isn't that like what DJs do? and he wrote 77 West Houston on the back of his card, and he's like, go there and give this to the lady in charge. And that's how I met these guys and had my mind blown, and the course of my life changed.
And so you got into craft cocktailing, and then you merged it into tiki?
For me, tiki was always fascinating. I was a booze nerd since I was 13.
Why not?
Yeah. In Latin families, rum has like a rite of passage kind of quality.
I see.
So, you know, you get the tiniest thimble as a tween, and like when you turn 13, your cousins kidnap you, take you to the pub downstairs, and tell you you're not leaving until they carry you.
Yikes. Is that a nice memory?
It was amazing. It was one of the best nights of my life. I started at Amaretto and I ended with Zwack.
Okay.
It was incredible. And I thought I was like some kind of alcoholic super soldier. They were all like, how did you do that? The next time I drank, I had the booze flu for like a good 3 days.
Oh, yes.
Beginner's luck. It took a while to convince everybody, but... You know, we're beating this drum like, guys, look around. Like, you see a Burger King ad, and there's this beautiful oak cutting board, and the Whopper is glorified on that, and the fries are in a steel pail, and it looks all so crafty pub burger.
Yeah.
Because that's what freaking Burger King has to emulate in order to stay relevant now.
Okay.
Like, a, you know, like Slow Foods with yeah. the other Allen cats. Yeah, there's two of us.
Boo.
What they did, like, you know, the Dan Barber stuff, the Alice Waters stuff, that change in culinary culture that was detailed in the United States of Arugula, that dovetailed with the cocktail movement. Those restaurant bars were the bars that were developing, or rather rediscovering this craft and bringing it back to crafthood.
Yeah.
Now you can go just about anywhere and get a decent gimlet, get an old-fashioned that isn't like a massacre of crazy red fake cherries and old orange slices.
But what if someone wants that?
I will serve it with such a smile.
Oh, that's good. Good.
But the cherries, the cherries are going to be proper Marasca cherries, and that orange will be very fresh.
Fresh orange. Who's going to complain about that? So also, we should say that these delicious Mai Tais that you prepared for us today, we didn't have to pay for the alcohol. So we should shout out the alcohol vendors.
Heck yes. Grupo Campari.
Yay, Grupo Campari.
They own Appleton Estate, which is where our 12-year-old rum comes from, as well as Grand Marnier. And we blend Grand Marnier with raw turbinado sugar to create our own Curacao. We picked that up from Sasha Petrasky, who was one of the co-founders of the modern cocktail movement. Last but not least, Room Clément. An incredible place if you ever go to Martinique. It's
I'm going there tomorrow. No, I'm not.
So much about it hasn't changed in 200 years.
Yeah?
Yeah, so like now it's like a big like ecotourism spot.
Oh, okay.
But that's just because the AOC, the same organization that oversees cognac and French wine, oversees Martinique, and the laws are so stringent that it just never changed because the rum was
always
phenomenal.
They're in charge of alcohol and an island?
Alcohol throughout France and its protectorates.
Oh, well, all right. Sounds great. Okay, well, Allen Katz, thank you so much for being with us
today. Thank you
today.
For having me.
Yes.
Fast.
And I don't know how long everybody is in town for, but if you have a chance, go to Jammyland, his restaurant.
We will party.
Yes, exactly.
Bring your Scoops Fest tag, and there will be shots. Let's do this.
Everybody, I'm Catherine Spires. This has been Smart Mouth. Thank you so much for hanging out. And a toast to everybody today at Scoops Fest.